By way of introduction, I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy who has a continuing interest in pharmacy leadership. The purpose of this conversation with a successful person is so we can all benefit from their experiences. I'd like to introduce Pamela A. Pletz. Pam got her undergraduate pharmacy degree at the University of Wisconsin. She's held leadership positions as a pharmacy supervisor, an assistant director, and an associate director at the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you, Sarah.
Let's begin with what stimulated you to seek pharmacy as a career, as in the early 60s, there weren't many women that went into pharmacy.
It is sort of an interesting story. My dad thought that I should have a major after being in school for 3 years. And so what he did is he said, you got a little time, but you got to have something. So, you know, in those days you had to look through the card catalogs and you figured out what matched up with your courses you already had. And there were two, English or something in medicine. And it was physician, pharmacist, or nurse, or a teacher. Well, English didn't seem like that would be very much fun. And so that one sort of got bollocks, and I went and met with the med school. Didn't like that. And so I went to the pharmacy school, and Gus Lemberger, who has been a leader in pharmacy over the years that you know also, he happened to be the person that talked to me. And he, of course, sold me on the idea that it would be very flexible so that when I got married and I had children, which never happened, as you know, it would work out for me. And so that's how I ended up in pharmacy way back when.
So tell us the story about finding your first pharmacy job.
That also was a bit interesting. That was a year my mother died, and I didn't know if I was going to graduate because, you know, I had all this stuff, work that I hadn't completed. So they really didn't figure out that I could graduate until like the end of April, and so I was sort of scurrying around to figure out where I could get a job. So I had worked in a hospital, and so I wanted to work in a community pharmacy to see if I liked it. So I called this leading clinical little pharmacy that was in Madison, and they said, well, they couldn't hire me because I was a woman. And I laughed because I thought they were kidding. They weren't kidding. They would not hire me. They wouldn't even interview me. They wouldn't talk to me. So that made me scurry back to the nuns at St. Mary's, because they had hired me during the summer, and then they said that they would hire me at St. Mary's Hospital in Madison. So that's how I ended up in hospital pharmacy as my career, because of somebody saying no to me because I was a woman a long time ago.
So how and where did you come of age professionally and learn to work in teams?
I think it was when I went to university hospitals, and this was in 1970, and they had decentralized pharmacy teams, and you were assigned to a nursing unit, and you worked with the nurses there and the physicians there, and there was one of you, and the rest were physicians and nurses. And I think that's how I learned about teamwork, because in those days there weren't a lot of anybody and there were a lot of patients because the length of stay was so long. And so you really spent a lot of time just helping other people out and whatever needed to be done. So I think that's really where it all started working. And another interesting thing is that Marianne Ivey was one of the pharmacists there, and she did some of the training for me.
It is small world. It is a small world.
It's a very small
health
world.
System pharmacy.
It's so, a very small.
In your experience, what's the value of the healthcare team?
Well, I guess from my perspective, it makes it more fun. One, and if you're going to work, it's nice to sort of like it. And two, that you realize everybody doesn't have all the right answers. And so if you're working together collectively, I think you come to a better answer for a patient than maybe any one of you would get to on your own.
You worked for 5 years as a staff pharmacist and then accepted the promotion as a pharmacy supervisor. Talk to us about that career decision.
Oh, that was really hard. They asked me to be a supervisor, And I agreed to do it if I could do both, because I thought, you know, I was all-knowing and all-wise, and I could somehow do both of those jobs. And, you know, that didn't work very long, because you clearly realize that you can't, you didn't do either one well. And, but trying to decide on leaving pharmacy, clinical pharmacy, where you get that immediate reward of somebody getting better, mm-hmm. Or getting worse, you saw results, versus going to a management position where you might see a result, you know, or you might not, even worse. But a lot of it, you never see the end, an end point. So I think, you know, it just seemed like something you do. So I took advantage of the opportunity. And I guess that's one of the things I would tell young people or anybody now, is to always take advantage of opportunities. And I'm sure you missed some along the way, and I certainly did, for a variety of reasons. But I do think that's basically what it was.
So any advice on how to cope with that lack of daily achievements that is part of being a leader?
I think, you know, I think I remember Bruce Scott's talk at Keeping Your Eye on the Prize, and I guess that's it. You have to be able to take a longer view of things than the short view. And there are some days you need some short-term things that you can feel good about, and you got to figure that into your schedule. Otherwise, you know, you can get pretty frustrated. It's probably the best thing to do is to step back and just, you know, instead of get yourself a little bit out of the fray, and then you can really see that you really have accomplished something. But if you're in it daily, it gets lost, I think.
So you moved up then as an assistant director and an associate director for the clinical services at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics. Share with us your philosophy of practice, and let's get into some specifics about how those clinical services really functioned.
Okay, so my philosophy for pharmacy is that if it's related to drugs, a pharmacist should be involved. And then whether you call it a client, a customer, or a patient, that has to be your focus of matching up the drug or not with that patient. And so how did we get to the clinical services? That started, again, in an interesting way, back from Wynne Durant and Dave Zills and Tom Thilke. When they decentralized the services, they took away they had one Cardex, medication Cardex, and instead of having the nurse write down all the drug orders, the pharmacist did it. And then the nurse co-signed it, because it made sense that they know the drugs, they know how to spell them, the pharmacist ought to do it instead of, you know, making all the changes. So that sort of put the pharmacist in the position of being there to take care of the patients. So you do that, you do it 24/7. So we were there all the time, you know, early in the morning, late at night. So the nurses depended on you, physicians depended on you. So pretty soon, well, why aren't you doing the medication histories? I mean, you know the drugs. Why is a nurse doing them? Well, so then we took over medication histories. Then pretty soon it was you're on rounds to make sure the orders were right before you, you know, implemented them. So it just sort of evolved, all these things. And it was a big challenge then, because those were the days, I'm sure you remember, where you had the clinical specialist or you had everybody doing things. We were of the mode where everybody did things. And even at one time, we were in charge of medication administration, much like Ohio State, where we had pharmacy techs doing med administration. So it was really being there and how it was set up really from the beginning and just evolved over time.
So the value of both pharmacy and nursing working off of one document had to be a large improvement.
Huge, huge. Because there weren't the errors of that translation of, you know, missing doses. And the pharmacist was in charge of making sure the doses were in the medication cart for that patient. And so, again, there was the pharmacist talking to pharmacies downstairs as opposed to nursing making the call saying you're missing this, you're missing that, whatever. So I think that was another thing. It decreased that conflict that you hear about everywhere. And you helped them, you know?
So as you came on at your shift as a clinical pharmacist, when did you verify the doses were there?
At that time, it varied over time, but we always did, had a medication card exchange at the beginning of in the morning. At 6:30, we had to be there. Mm-hmm. And then we had it at 2:30, which is before the nurses came on and before the other shift left. And then we did one before we went home. And then overnight, we had a clinical pharmacist that was there that covered more units, and so they weren't responsible for any of the checking of carts or anything.
And were IV admixtures handled the same way in terms of the single document and verifying mm-hmm. of doses mm-hmm. being there?
They were. And again, it simplified things by having the one document. And we, you know, then the charging and everything, you didn't have all those credits because you only got charged for what was administered. So all of those kinds of things that were sort of messed up in the system smoothed out, I guess is what I would say.
And clearly that would take a few more staff to do. How did you accomplish that at the University of Wisconsin?
Well, clearly one was stable leadership. We had even administratively, we had people that were there for a long time, both in the pharmacy department and in the hospital. So that helped. And having that vision of what it was going to be or what it should be. And then it really evolution, I think, is the best way to describe it, of taking opportunity when, you know, there was a nursing shortage. That's when we took over the med administration. Mm-hmm. And that was when we started doing more of the med histories. You know, then there would be a problem with people getting medications for when they went home. So pharmacists took over providing discharge medications and counseling before they went home. So it became really opportunity or a problem that initiated, and then from there.
So were pharmacy technicians used by the clinical people?
Yes.
And describe that role.
In the beginning, the pharmacist did all the transcription. Well, eventually, technicians did the transcription and pharmacists signed off on the orders, and then it became who put the orders into a computer and verifying. So it just, again, evolved. So they used it for that. They used it for medication administration, filling PRN carts before they had medication carts, automated carts that they have now. They filled all of those. So again, you know what? It's not nice to say that technicians were replaced by some of the robotics, but in all reality, that's what happened. So if you look at what the robots do now, then you can tell what technicians really did before that.
And as I remember when we recorded Dave Zill's conversation, that as the director of pharmacy, he reported directly to the CEO, mm-hmm. much like we talk about today, the chief pharmacy officer. And so when you talk about stable leadership, that would be a value of a chief pharmacy officer today, do you think?
Absolutely. You got it. And you have to be working. They have to understand pharmacy. And I think if you don't have that voice at the top, they can't understand it as clearly. I mean, I'm sure that you went through, so I know, because we've talked about the frustrations of, you know, them saying, well, you have to cut your drug costs. And you're thinking, and we're expanding the oncology department. There is a disconnect there. Or we're doing more transplants. I mean, so I think when you have that direct conversation, that helps, you know, the whole flow of pharmacy services, quite frankly.
So some current pharmacy practice issues must give you a sense of deja vu, that it's happening all over again. Any thoughts on how to implement and sustain best practices and facilitate the spread, really, of best practices today?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. You know, I think about like medication reconciliation. That is like med histories. We were doing that in the 70s. I just don't know how. I think we have to work at getting pharmacists and pharmacy students from the very beginning. If you have time to get somebody a dose of a drug, do you not have time to find out if it's going to be the right thing by making sure you know what they have on board already or what they've been taking? And with the increased complexity, I mean, when you and I started, there was aspirin, DIG, potassium. I don't want to remind you. I mean, there weren't this, you know, the complexity there is now. So it's even more important that they do it now. So I'm very glad. So maybe, just maybe, this time around it will stick. But how many times have we seen it? Another one is looking at the value of clinical services and staffing patterns. How many times have we been through this? A bazillion. And yet, even though there was a recent article in AJHP, I'm not sure that they validated it using it for staffing models anyplace else. So again, are we reinventing the wheel? I don't think we know yet. I don't know.
One of the other responsibilities you had was the residency program director. What does being an RPD entail?
Work. No, fun, actually. Our pharmacy practice residency program started because we had a big administrative program at the University of Wisconsin, which everybody was acquainted with. And we had what we call pharmacy interns. And all of a sudden one day I was looking at the criteria for pharmacy practice residencies and I thought, this is ridiculous. We've got to put our internship, make that a pharmacy practice residency, because it was, that's what they were doing. So that's how that got started and evolved. And I think what became important then was that they got recognition and they, we got more recognition for within the hospital for having these people that were trying to, you know, expand and perfect their skills. So it was a higher level than, quote, being an intern for whatever reason. And I think that it, from my perspective, it's interesting always to see the new people in a formalized manner get experiences so that they can better make choices about what they might want to do next. And that's really what you were trying to do, is to give them a broad opportunity to put their skills and knowledge to work and then help them decide what they might want to do next.
So did the residents become kind of a feeder system for staff positions when you had them open?
They did. And we also tried to encourage them to go elsewhere if they wanted to, because, and then maybe come back. It's always, I think, a good idea for people to get an idea of what else is out there. And if you've done a pharmacy practice residency, that means you're only out of college for 1 year. It helps, I think, if people get an opportunity to go someplace. Now, that's not always true. Some people, you know, had constraints because they were maybe had married or, you know, a number of things. So obviously we did hire some people that, you know, that obviously you trained them. So from an employer side, it's definitely a benefit. But from the pharmacy practice residency, I think it helps if they get more experience in going other places or more an advanced program after that.
What are the benefits to doing a program, do you think, for the rest of the staff?
I think, from my perspective, you get an opportunity to get new ideas. And when you, because we're an academic institution, you always had students around. So you had to be up to snuff on things. But it is always, I think, a good idea to constantly be teaching other people, because that helps you learn and keep abreast of what you need to learn also. And they challenge you. They challenge you about how you do things. Why do you do it? And if you have to answer why you're doing something and you can't, then it makes you think, well, yeah, why are we doing this? That's all good. Otherwise, why would we change? I mean, none of us really like to change. So I think that's probably the biggest benefit for everybody, though on some days you wouldn't want to admit that.
Residents and pharmacists who've worked with you always comment on your commitment to mentoring and developing them. Why spend time developing other people?
People are interesting. And I think from the pharmacy personnel are, for the most part, pharmacists that you're going to hire are smart. You know, they've gone through school. They're smart. So really what you want to impart to them are values. And I feel, I mean, so strongly about patient care and the need for a pharmacist that that's what you try and get people to think about and to do. Now, I guess spending my time developing them, everybody's got a story. And what is their story? What are their goals? How do they think they're going to get there? And, you know, during that whole process, you also learn and grow. I mean, we had people from Saudi Arabia in our residency program. Well, do you think we didn't have to, you know, adjust to cope? Yeah, that's good. That is good. That helps, I think, all of us be better people, more open. You always get more out of it than, it's a selfish thing. You get a lot out of it. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. So I guess, you know, I learned a lot, you know.
So in precepting residents specifically, do you have some guidance for the audience on that, how to be an effective preceptor?
I think you have to care. You have to care about them. If it's just a job or it's just, you know, part of on your position description or something you're going to check up, you're not going to be good at it. You really have to want to do it, and you have to like doing it, and you got to see the humor in it. You've got to like the challenges of it, helping them see how they're growing when they're in despair. We've talked over the years, you can't make some of this stuff up, the things they come up with that are problems. So, I think it's all about trying to listen to their story and figure out what fits for them.
Most of your career, pharmacy was pretty much a male-dominated profession. It's kind of balancing out now, but what advice do you give to women pharmacists?
It's all about choices. I don't think you ever have balance. You just don't. It's not how life goes. It just is not in balance. I don't care what it is or what you're doing. It's about choices. And you need to be very thoughtful about those choices. And they have to be your answer, your choice, because then you'll feel good about it, whatever it is. And I think what I tried to do, going back to really to residents or staff or anybody, is to try and encourage people to figure out what would work best for them in their life. Now, you and I have talked about it before. I never left Wisconsin. I never left Madison. I moved 30 miles in my entire life. Well, excuse me, that was a choice. Now, so that made, you know, that was differences about where you're going to go, what you're going to do. But it worked best for me with my family. So, you know, I think you need people to make, and then own it. You got to own it. Because if you don't own it, then you start pointing fingers and blaming people for why this or why that or, you know, and that's not a positive.
So your commitment to developing other people, how did you handle the inevitable situation of having to truly discipline somebody and still maintain that relationship?
Well, I have to say, I don't, you know, pharmacy technicians now there because they were all unionized, there were certain ways you had to go about disciplining people. Those were usually easy because it was usually they were not showing up. And if you are not there, I don't care how good a job you do when you are here. If you're not there, it can't be done. So those were easy. I think the professional staff was a little more challenging, and it's always, from my way of thinking, best to let them figure out, if you can, figure out how it's not working. Because usually it's a bad fit. It was a bad hire that you own also. Circumstances have changed and people haven't been willing to change, and you have to give them opportunity to, but they, you know, it's not working. So it usually is a bad fit for a number of reasons, and helping them to see it. Now, it's never easy. It is never, and you, even if all of your staff thinks it's a good idea what's happening, the entire hospital thinks it's a good idea, once you make that decision, you are the bum. And you really have to realize that you have to do it for the right thing and the right reasons. You have to be clear about what it is you're doing and why you're doing it, so that you can feel good about the decision, because you can't second guess yourself.
Well, and I always felt if I didn't do that, I was being unfair to the rest of the staff as well.
Exactly. You know, it's the common good of trying to get the organization to be able to move forward. And there's, you know, things change. And so it's life. Move on, as they say.
You've been active throughout your career in professional organizations. You were president of the Wisconsin Society of Hospital Pharmacists. What does being president of a state chapter entail?
Well, that's a good question, because I have two opportunities there. I started out, I think it was like 1980, I was president of WSHP. And that was an all-volunteer organization where you did everything from stuffing envelopes to, you know, driving with somebody else in a car to go do a night meeting someplace or some crazy, you know, thing. All volunteer. So you were always scurrying to, in, like, I think it was around 2000, I was president of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, which is a combination organization between the Wisconsin Pharmaceutical Association, the Wisconsin Society. That we had an executive director, Chris Decker, who does a lot, the whole staff. Oh, so we went from lots of work to really a different kind of work. It wasn't all the little picky stuff, but it was all the stuff of trying to lead a big organization, represent everybody at the, you know, to the governor and the legislature, and to try and get people interested in belonging to the organization, get more members, to attending meetings, to, you know, just trying to advocate for pharmacy in the state of Wisconsin. So it was two different, distinctly different experiences, both very rewarding, learned a ton, and met wonderful people. And I guess that would be the best, wonderful people that you work with.
So the merging of the hospital pharmacy group at the state level with the pharmacist group, what are the pros and cons of that? And I'm sure that was not an easy decision for both organizations.
Well, you know, they went through a big, lengthy process with a facilitator where they came up with one voice, one vision. And it really came out of the fact that we were doing some legislative work, and the two organizations were not aligned. And basically, they have a health committee where all your legislation goes, and they looked at the two groups and said, you know, get it together. You know, come back when you figure it out. Well, that's when you realize this really wasn't working being two. You really need to come in with one voice. And, you know, there was the sniping between the hospital people and the community people, and it wasn't. And you could see that if you were going to do the best job for patients, you really had to be better connected. So with this new, the new accountable care organizations, all of those things really make sense to this unified organization. So in Wisconsin, I'm not saying it would work any, you know, any place else, but it has really worked well, and it's been a very rewarding experience. And I think that we've done just so much better, as if nothing else, representing ourselves to the public and to the, you know, the regulators.
And you're certainly true. Accountable care organizations, the transition of care from the acute care into the community and back and forth is what we need to improve in healthcare.
And if you're seeing these people at the meetings and you're hearing about their issues and you're knowing something that you could be helpful about when you're translating to them, well, all of that then just makes it better. It's a lot easier to be nice to somebody if you can put a face to it, as opposed to you're yelling on a phone to somebody. So I think that, or angry or snippy or what have you. It's no different than in a hospital when you decentralize the pharmacist. It was harder for the nurses to yell or the physicians to yell at the pharmacist if they were looking right at them. You're a little kinder.
You also have served on the Wisconsin State Pharmacy Examining Board, or what would be called the Board of Pharmacy in most states. How are appointments made to a Board of Pharmacy generally, or at least in Wisconsin?
Money and influence. By money I mean how much you donate to political parties. Follow the dollar. And the other is influence. So you are usually recommended by either your state organization or school, or you nominate yourself, or you've got to connect with the governor somewhere, or the governor owes somebody and it's an appointment they will do. So it's gotten a lot more political than it used to be, but I guess I shouldn't say that, because I think the way I got on, much to my surprise, had nothing to do with me or anything, quite honestly. They didn't talk to anybody. My dad was acquainted with this legislator, and he called up my dad and said, "I heard your daughter's a pharmacist. Do you think she'd want to be on the Board of Pharmacy?" My dad never asked me, never talked to me. He said, "Yeah, I think she might like that." There you go. Happened.
So they're generally a governor appointment. Contribution politically to that party and or working in campaigns.
Right.
And my experience in a couple of states is that the pharmacy organizations,
yes,
oftentimes will suggest as well.
And again, if your organization is aligned with that governor or has been supporting and things have been working smoothly, then they listen to you more than if that's not working smoothly.
So what are the activities of a Board of Pharmacy? I think what pharmacists, we see them as policing our licenses, but I think you do more than that.
A lot of times you're trying to look at the laws. Somebody will ask you a practice question, and you're looking at the law to see if it's legal or not legal. And many of the regulations are old and they don't fit new practice. And so it's trying to figure out how to do that. And a good example is almost all pharmacy practice say your pharmacy has to look like, how many square feet, all this stuff. Well, what happens if you're an independent pharmacist and you're working at a desk talking to patients coming in, you're not even dealing with drugs? Those kinds of questions and conflict they try to resolve. They also usually do have a licensing function and a relicensing function. They deal with complaints, so pharmacists who are impaired. Mm-hmm. They make judgments on those things, or like I said, complaints where there's been maybe a major error. Those are the typical things.
And there is a chairman of the Board of Pharmacy, and you served as that office. What was your role then? It's a leadership position as chairman.
Well, setting the agenda, which sounds like it's not a big deal, but if you think about anybody that's worked, you set the agenda. One, you set the tone, and you are really guiding what's going to be done, what's going to be accomplished, what is the work that's going to be done. So that's probably the biggest. Plus, you're the face of the Board of Pharmacy in that state, so you are out at meetings, you're at the governor's office, you're on committees, you're testifying for things that are related but are not maybe in your laws, so you're invited to provide testimony on, you know, a veterinary bill or what have you. So things of that sort, you spend a lot of time. It's very time consuming. I found it, I figured that I spent probably minimum 10 hours at the Board of Pharmacy during that time, during when I was chairman, a week. That's a lot, you know, because it's on top of what you're trying to do at your job also.
Now, there is a paid executive secretary, correct?
No.
No, you had no paid.
No.
So you literally then, as the chairman, were representing and doing
right. They
everything.
Had an administrative assistant that really helped you. And you had legal staff. Hmm. But they had one, they called him a secretary, and she or he were the secretary of all the boards that they licensed, which, you know, so we're talking from cosmetology and barbers to physicians. So it's a, you know, and they were over all of them.
So tell us about NABP and what it is and what its role is.
Their role, at least at the time, was they had like a Model Pharmacy Practice Act that they developed and always tweaked so that if you were proposing new legislation, you could go there and look and see what the model was for this, and it was supposed to be the most contemporary as possible. They also run all the national licensing, which I think there should be, and you shouldn't even have state licenses. That's my bias. I think ASHP, everybody should work to having one license. People don't just stay in one place. They need to be flexible. We need to, but they take care of that. They take care of reciprocity going between places. And they, too, serve as a voice for the laws of pharmacy out in all of the other organizations. So their biggest thing is to get everybody trying to sing out of the same hymnal, as they say. And as you know, that's like herding cats. It's hard.
So did the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy have a national meeting that you attended?
Yes, they do. And again, it's fun, and they have a lot of people, you know, talking about the different issues and how do we take care of impairment, you know? So you talk about what works in one state versus another, because no states run the same way. And, you know, tried to get ideas from one to another and then to figure out if they would be implementable in your own. So it's a sharing of ideas and issues that go across all states that you can be unified as you, again, that person then presents to other major organizations.
Now, in Wisconsin, was there a seat for a health system pharmacist, or was it just, again, the general appointment process?
Just the general appointment process. They did try and keep it, you know, balanced, but it was serendipitous a lot of times.
And again, having somebody represent who understood health system pharmacy would be helpful.
Yes. But as you know, now it's much different. You know, a lot of community pharmacies are doing IVs, injectables, same way hospitals are doing ambulatory care. So there's a lot more now where there is a crossover, as opposed to when it was more distinct when, you know, we started our careers. So it's sort of come around.
That's a good point. You currently serve on the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy's Board of Visitors, which is commonly called the Dean's Advisory Group. Talk a little bit about what those are, because I think most schools of pharmacy have a Dean's Advisory Group.
That's fun, too. You know, it's a nice thing to do when you're in the swan song of your career. And you have your role there is to provide feedback to the dean about what's happening in the world in healthcare, your perspective in pharmacy, and any tidbit that you can provide to the dean or the school. It's to help them maintain their relevancy. But bottom line is, it's about the money. And again, it's making contributions of time or money to promote that school. And, you know, that's what you do. And you try and do it a number of ways. One of the things that I was really interested in was student philanthropy. I didn't understand why there was this gap where people, you know, would get out of school and they didn't give money. Even people who had received scholarships, I wanted to think, where did you think that money came from? And I couldn't get it. So we have a whole new, it's actually a very exciting program at Wisconsin where they're getting students from day one to look at investing into the future. And each class, I think this is will be the third year where they have started a scholarship for to be given out to students. So it's really is rewarding to see that, you know, we're starting earlier on the payback of, you know, you've been really, if you get to be a pharmacist, you have been very fortunate that you have been able to go to a school and, you know, be educated. In your many communities, you're the most educated or one of the most educated people. That you have to, that's a high obligation, I think.
What are your wishes for young emerging leaders as they find their way in this complex environment that we're in?
Luck. Oh, I think it is very hard for the complexity. One of the things I try to always impart to people is to think about, besides always focusing on the patient, but I think that ethics are a very challenging issue. And I always encourage people to think about the most far out ethical issue that they can think about in all of them and think about what they would do. Because when you are faced with an ethical issue, you don't, oftentimes you don't have time to really think about it. You need to have thought about it ahead of time. And so I think that's, I try to get people to think of that and put those two things when they're making decisions. And then to remember that really most decisions aren't, you know, finite, etched in granite, that you do, you can change and move on and you're going to make mistakes and, you know, just do the best you can.
Do you have any examples of the ethics that you talk about?
A good example is, you know somebody's stealing narcotics and you know who it is. And they say, well, that'd be easy. I would just call somebody and turn them in. And I say, well, what if they were chairman of the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee? Then what would you do? What if they were the most influential physician in your community? Then what would you do? And how would you do it? Well, as you can see, and you've dealt with it, the layers of complexity of things like that are immense. And it could be, you know, narcotics, or it could be regular drugs. We've had colleagues that people were stealing out of their, in their supply chain and supplying who knows who. Well, you know, those are complex issues that you can, I mean, there's so many of them that you can bring up to talk to people about, like, what would you do? And then if you add, most people are very clear about what they would do on the front, you know, the first quick answer. And they say, well, what if? And then it's like, yeah. And it's always a little gray. It's never just this or that. It's always pretty gray. Maybe that's one of the things you and I both learned, that there's always probably three sides to a story, or four or five or ten, and you have to make sure you've got all sides before you jump in and make decisions.
And probably the bottom line is you've got to do something.
Right.
You can think about it for a little while, but you can't just ignore it.
And that's the importance of having some colleagues within the institution or outside the institution that you can call and say, have a discussion with, you know, this is what's happening with me. Have you run into it? Have you, what did you do? What have you heard people have done? You know, and get some feedback. But I think it's real important to have people that you can trust, that you can talk to, so you are not sort of alone in making those decisions.
If you could go back in time, what would you focus on today as a leader? If you were back as the associate director at Wisconsin,
where would you focus? I'd listen more.
To whom?
Everybody.
And why?
I think as complexity increases, you tend to want to make some decisions. And so you just want to get some things checked off your list that you can get done. And sometimes you need to stop and let the process evolve, and then you make a better decision, or a better decision. You've achieved more buy-in. In the long run, it will go a lot more smoothly, as opposed to just, saying, this is the way it is. So you have to bring people along. But I really worked with wonderful people, talented, smart, committed. Now, I didn't always agree with them, but I knew that they were doing it for the right reasons. People are doing things for the right reasons. You can have a discussion with them. And the people that are not doing it for the right reasons, you want to have that other discussion we talked about earlier. You want to show them where this is not a good fit and move them over.
In this age of email, would you do this listening over email?
Absolutely not. I think you have to have some face-to-face conversations with people. You can't read people on an email. You don't know if they had a bad day and they just were, you were the fourth person that came along and you were going to get it. You don't know if they were venting or it's really an issue. Many times it's hard to sort that out from an email. So the first thing I always try to do is go call them or say, can I come and talk to you? Or go to them and say, do you have a minute? Or if you don't, I'm ready to talk about whatever it is. I think you need the face-to-face always is preferable, unless it's something that's, organic, that it doesn't matter. It's just something feedback on. You're going to be someplace at a certain time or an agenda, those kinds of things that make sense.
Pam, as you reflect back over your career, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
I think what's most satisfying to me are the people. I can still remember some patients I helped, so that's always there. But since I transitioned into more of a management role, it's the people along the way, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think it's very rewarding to see the variety of careers that people have gone into, the success they've achieved. I'm like a proud parent of watching them. I mean, I just think it's just so cool. In the same way with the staff, and faculty, all of them, I've been around since longer than dirt. And it's just fun to see these young people go and do wonderful, wonderful things. I can't say enough about, and are you not rewarded by doing that? They come back to you and say, hey, even some thank you way down the line. But it is, I was in a restroom at a crazy meeting on eyes. And this lady came up to me and she said, are you Pam Pletz? And I said, yes. And she said, well, you don't remember me, but you were on the faculty and you were on the discipline committee and you helped me, and I get to thank you. And you're like, I don't have a clue who she was. I have no recollection of what. But those are the things that you're saying, wow, you did make a difference and you did have fun. And I was very fortunate. So I guess I'm just grateful of the people I met and what I all learned along the way. And outside of just Madison, but you know, you and all my colleagues in pharmacy, I'm just fortunate, and can't complain about it at all. I just think I was very fortunate in life.
Let's talk about being a mentor, because you have been and continue to be. Say a young person that views this conversation sees you at a meeting. Do you welcome them coming up and chatting with you?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because this is my selfish person. I learn from them. I get to know something new about somebody, what they're dealing with, what their concerns are. Many times they just need somebody to talk to them and tell them they're great. They're doing the right thing. They're going down a good path, you know, or what other alternatives there might be. I think sometimes when people are stuck, you know, you just can't see the forest or the trees. And if you can just help them see that there's really a lot of opportunity and to view it differently, change it around a little, get a different perspective, that, you know, they can go off and so it's good. And, you know, I'm like this little bad penny. I'll just, you know, I'll email somebody and say, so what about, you know, our conversation, you know, last month, where are you at? And they'll be like, nowhere, or they did, or they feel better about it, where they're going and what they're doing. So I think a lot of times it is just listening, and, you know, I have the opportunity to do that now and not have to worry about, you know, getting, you know, the JCHO coming or something like that, or somebody calling in sick. So it's a good thing.
Are there other pieces of advice you give young students or young pharmacists?
I am a huge advocate of travel. I tell everybody to travel. And I try and get people to do things outside of pharmacy. I can't tell you. I mean, people need to read things outside of pharmacy. They need to go places. They need to talk to people outside of pharmacy. You have no clue when you're just in your own little world. You have to reach out. And another thing that people always talk about leadership, you know, well, I want to be a director. I want to, you know, something. They want to be something. And I say, you know, you can be, you know, if you're head of your church, you are serving in a valuable community leadership position. If you run your kids' hockey, you know, games for a season, you're learning about scheduling. You are learning leadership, you know, tools that you can use everywhere. So don't look just within your narrow profession, but what is helping you be a better pharmacist? And it is a big picture. It is not just, you know, when you come in and do whatever you do, your job is or your position is. So I really try and encourage people to look outside. You know, what do they belong to? What do they do outside of work? What hobbies do you have? Are you doing them? And usually when people are disgruntled and unhappy or thinking about changing, what's gotten out of whack is they are not doing any of those things that give them rewards outside of work, and it's work has become too much of their whole life.
What are some recommendations of things for people to read outside of pharmacy that you've found valuable during your career?
Well, I'm sure you went through the same thing. If you're an administrator, you look at that Wall Street Journal to see if any drugs were, or any company is in trouble, you know, in the morning, because you're going to hear about it. Some physician's going to ask you, somebody's going to come up and ask you. So I always flip through the Wall Street Journal in the morning before I went to work. But I think, you know, again, the variety of things that you read or at least glance at and look at helps you understand where patients are coming from. I mean, drugs are what pharmacists think of. Most other people aren't sitting around thinking about drugs all the time. But if you watch the news every night, you would think that everybody has a sleeping problem. the whole entire world. And I mean, that's an example of, by the way, that's one of my better stories.
Please tell us.
I did a white paper with a group of people saying how wonderful it would be if there was advertising on television of drugs, because then people would be better educated. Oh, was that a mistake, huh? I mean, oh, now not that that white paper made the decision, but, you know, what was I thinking? I guess I never thought that it would go so awry, that we would be just bombarded with nonsense most of the time that's not even good for people. So it's, you know, you think back on some of the things that you thought were really good ideas and not so much.
You have also taught and precepted students through your career. What are some tips on how to be a good teacher or preceptor?
I think those are being a good teacher. Again, I think you have to care about students. And if you care that they learn, then you're going to work hard at making sure that not only are you providing the information or the skill, that what skills you want them to develop, but you're helping them, making sure that they are receiving that, getting it. So I guess I think that is so key to any of that. And when I was on the faculty, a lot of what I did, besides, you know, it was sort of that in the mode of the didactic stuff, and a lot of the other part I did was administratively. So I was on like the disciplinary committee, and you know, but that is good. You really can help people to move along in their career or change careers, because it's not a good thing. So I think another piece of that being on a faculty that I think is positive is when the hospital was a mess and, you know, just was driving you crazy, you could sort of change gears and put your, you know, school hat on. And when you put your school hat on, then what would happen is you could, you know, you get wound up in that and deal with that. And it sort of added perspective both places. So to me, I think whenever you're taking a position, if you have some things that are, you know, a two-track kind of thing, is it not a bad thing? Because you can sort of shift gears then, and then you have more tolerance.
As an associate director, you had responsibility for a unique kind of service at Wisconsin. It's the Center for Drug Policy and Clinical Economics. Tell us a little bit about what that did and how it was staffed.
It started out as drug information. And in the old days, they provided, you know, people would call up pharmacists or physicians or nurses with questions, and they would answer the drug questions. And once we became much more active in a pharmacy and therapeutics committee, that group of people were dealing with a lot of drug policy issues. And pretty soon, they were dealing a lot more with drug policy than with answering drug information. We had more pharmacists decentralized. Those people were answering more of the questions. So they were doing a lot more in-depth reviews of things and policy, anything that dealt with policy with drugs. And so consequently, and a lot about what you bought, because that was the days of trying to see if you could do therapeutic substitution that started out with that. So all this was drug policy, and so it evolved into that. Then as the economics came in, then it became even more important, because they were really making, you know, economic, big, huge economic decisions. And they worked, again, with physicians and nurses to achieve that. But it evolved into it. And there were, it went for, I don't know how many at the end, we had 5-6 people in that department. A lot, you know, it took a lot to, because it was, again, you were doing ambulatory as well as inpatient and outpatient, as they call it. And so it was big. And we also had a investigational drug service also that, again, it too went from small to large, and again, driven by economics, because if you're using investigational drugs, you're saving money on, you know, the real drugs. So it big departments driven by economics.
Thank you very much, Pam. This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sarah.